We're going to get started. My name is Karen Willem. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of Sugar CRM, which is a customer relationship management company here in Cupertino. And I'm also a board member of Watermark. I've been on the board for 10 years, and we welcome everybody here today. I'll be your MC for today's session, mostly introducing our leader today, who is Sophie Karasek, and I've got the name right. I'm thrilled to be here and to support the advancement of women leaders with a conference that offers a blend of practical tools and advice, inspiration, and peer networking. We're committed to your empowerment, to inspire you to make your mark in and for your companies, your careers, and your life. We have an amazing hour in store for you on the topic of everyday activism, how you can amplify your voice to end sexual violence. It's my pleasure to introduce Sophie Karasek. Sophie is an advocate for gender equity on campuses nationwide. She's a co-founder and the director of education of the survivor advocacy group End Rape on Campus. And prior to her graduation from the University of California, Berkeley in 2015, she spearheaded several federal complaints against Berkeley and has assisted students nationwide in holding universities accountable to Title IX. Karasek has also been a leading advocate for California's groundbreaking affirmative action consent law, and her work has been featured in national and international media, including The Wall Street Journal, The Guardian, CNN, and Bloomberg Businessweek. She is also a subject in the documentary film The Hunting Ground and was featured in Lady Gaga's performance at the 2016 Academy Awards. Put your hands together and welcome Sophie Karasek.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here today with all of you. As Karen said, I went to UC Berkeley, so I always love coming back to the Bay Area. So thank you for sharing this morning with me. So my name is Sophie Karasek again, and I'm the Director of Education and co-founder of End Rape on Campus, which is the national survivor advocacy organization that Annie Clark, myself, and other survivors from around the country co-founded back in 2013. We are a survivor advocacy organization in the sense that we provide survivors direct assistance to hold their schools accountable when they mishandle sexual assault cases. And we also do preventative education and advocate for legislative reform, as well as policy reform for individual campuses, states, and at the federal level as well. So I'm going to talk today about the student movement and some of the patterns that we've seen nationwide, and how you can get involved on your campus, in your community, and some of the really exciting opportunities that we have here in California specifically. So does that sound good to everybody? Great. Okay. Wonderful. So I want to talk a bit more about how I got involved in this issue and why this matters so much to me. So when I was a first year at UC Berkeley, I had moved to Cal from the East Coast. Berkeley was my dream school. I wanted to go there after learning about it in a history textbook. And I was like, that sounds like the perfect place for me. I would love to be there. And California is way warmer than the snow in Massachusetts, so better on all counts. But unfortunately, I joined a bunch of different organizations my first semester. But my second semester there, I joined another student group. And the first night that I was taking part in any kind of meeting with them, I was sexually assaulted by one of the board members of the organization. And it turned out that he was actually targeting systemically young girls in that club. And so he was 2 years older than me at the time, and he was going after first-year girls, particularly when they were asleep, as I had been, or had been drunk or unconscious in some other way. So we were really outraged to learn shortly after it happened to me that I was not the first person that he had done this to, that actually I was at least the third person who he had sexually assaulted in this club, and that there were other board members who had known about it. And so when it turned out that it wasn't just me, but rather that there was this guy who was serially sexually assaulting women in our organization, we decided that he should have to, do something, face some sort of consequence as a result of that. And so he resigned his leadership position at the board, and we were like, okay, great. Now he knows that you, can't touch people sexually or whatever when they are asleep. That is like not okay to do. Less than a month later, he sexually assaulted yet another person. And at that point, we were like, okay, something more needs to be done. And so we went to the UC Berkeley administration and formally reported him. And there were four of us at that point who like sat in a meeting with administrators and told them what had happened. And their response was to basically do nothing. So they didn't do an investigation. They ended up putting him on disciplinary probation, which means that if he had sexually assaulted yet another person, so if a fifth person had come forward, then maybe he would have faced some sort of consequence. And all of this led him to graduate early from Berkeley and now go to Harvard Law School. I'm from Cambridge, Massachusetts, so that's about a 15-minute walk from my house. So this is something that I have had to deal with and has profoundly affected my education for now going on 4 years. So it's something that is not just about the incident in of itself, but as Annie said this morning, it profoundly affects your life and can affect your educational experience and career trajectory as well. So what happened after he graduated was I found out that Berkeley was doing this systemically and that this wasn't something that had just happened in my case. And so we actually passed a bill of no confidence through our student government legislature. And it was a bill of no confidence in how Berkeley was handling these cases. And after that, I saw the New York Times article that Annie mentioned this morning as well. And that was when I reached out to Annie about what was happening at Cal. And so over the next couple of months after that New York Times article came out, we started to formulate what we were calling at the time the Nine Network, where we had survivors who were connecting across the country, sharing their experiences of institutional betrayal and sexual assault and sexual harassment, and using Title IX in new and accessible ways. So Title IX is the federal gender equity statute that protects students from gender discrimination in education, and that also encompasses sexual harassment and sexual assault, because, you know, that impacts how you learn and live. So we were using this new mechanism of filing complaints against schools without attorneys, but also we were framing it as a national issue that was not isolated to any one particular campus or part of the country, but rather that it was a national problem that demanded a national response. And so that's how we got to the point where we're at today, where now we're talking about campus sexual assault as a national problem. So what is Title IX? I want to just make sure that we are thinking about what exactly it is that has allowed us to be at the point that we're at today. So as Annie mentioned this morning, we're really standing on the shoulders of women who have come before us and have fought for these really important statutes and many other things. So Title IX is a law that was enacted in 1972 that protects students from gender discrimination. And in particular now, it prevents students from experiencing a hostile environment in school. So if like there is a boy who is like picking on you and saying sexual comments to you and that makes you anxious and or like saying things about your body that make it difficult for you to focus, that would be an example of a hostile environment. So it's not just sexual assault and rape, although that certainly does have a huge impact on your education, but it can also be the derogatory comments that can happen on a daily basis. Then also that there's immediate action required by the school. So it's not just an issue for law enforcement. People often think about rape and sexual assault and think, okay, so that's an issue that the police deal with. And certainly it could be something that law enforcement deals with, but this, again, is a civil rights law, and so you're supposed to feel safe in school, and so the school is supposed to take action to make sure that that happens. Excuse me. Also, Title IX applies to K through 12 as well. So if you're in high school, these same rules apply. Schools are supposed to make sure that this is an environment that you feel safe and comfortable in. The preponderance of the evidence standard is something that is a little legally and can be difficult to understand, but if you think about how in the criminal justice system you have to prove that someone is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, that is a level of certainty of 99%. In the campus setting, it's around 51%, what's called more likely than not. And so it's a different process as well for finding somebody responsible. Does that make sense? Cool. Okay. So the other piece of legislation that we've used a lot within the last couple of years is called the Clery Act. And this has started out as a statistics law, so making sure that schools are publishing information about crimes that happen on or near campus, but also has evolved over the last 20 years or so to also include important rights for survivors. So the five rights in the Campus Sexual Assault Victims Bill of Rights are all about ensuring that you have, you know, due process rights, essentially, in your case. So making sure that you're both informed of the outcome of the disciplinary proceeding. So like, if your perpetrator is found responsible, that the school tells you. So in my case with Berkeley, they told me only 3 days after he graduated that he was found responsible. So that didn't allow me the opportunity to appeal what had happened. And they basically told me that he was found responsible, but they didn't say that he was put on disciplinary probation until more than a year after that. So that would be an example of how the Clery Act was violated. Then also that you're supposed to have the same opportunity to present. So like, if he has the opportunity to appeal, then so am I. Then I'm supposed to have that same opportunity. And that you have to be notified of your options as well. So you're not required to go to law enforcement, or you're not required to go to counseling or any of those things, but the school is supposed to tell you that those options exist. And then also that you can get academic and living accommodations as well. So a lot of times survivors will have been sexually assaulted in a dorm or by somebody who lives on their floor. And so that obviously would be a hostile environment to be in. And so schools are supposed to tell you that you can change that situation. So as of 2013, this has also expanded to include required preventative education as well, which is great, great important step forward, making sure that that's available not just to incoming students, but also to employees. Having a definition of consent as well. Here in California, we worked on yes means yes. How many people have heard of yes means yes? Okay, so like a good number of folks. So yes means yes is basically the idea that you, if you are initiating sexual activity, you have to make sure that the other person is okay with it. And it's reframing the idea of sex as being one that is cooperative and mutual, as opposed to being something that you're taking from another person, and that you're not necessarily going to know whether or not they're comfortable with it unless they say something, which is not in line with what happens a lot of the time when you're experiencing sexual assault, since oftentimes survivors react to sexual assault by freezing, and so they don't necessarily say no. So that's something that's important to know as well. Title II regards disability access to school regardless of ability. So if you have experienced PTSD or anxiety or depression as a result of sexual assault, for instance, that is something that a school is supposed to provide you an accommodation with. And so that's something that we've also filed complaints to the U.S. Department of Education about as well. So part of why we have been able to do all of this is because in 2011, the Obama administration put out guidance to schools called a Dear Colleague Letter that basically said to schools, okay, this is what you're supposed to do under Title IX. It clarified existing law and said that there were certain things that schools needed to make sure that they were doing. So, for instance, that if you file a case to the police, that doesn't mean that the school can't do anything. That does not relieve the school of the opportunity or responsibility to investigate. Then that you have the right to end the informal process at any time, and that mediation between a perpetrator and a survivor is never appropriate for sexual violence cases. Then that retaliation is prohibited. So that can mean both, like, if you go to the school and then they say fire you from your RA position because you reported a case, that would be an example of retaliation that would be prohibited. But also, if you report a case and then the perpetrator's friends start making you afraid, or, you know, follow you around and say things that that make you feel like it's a hostile environment, that's also an example of retaliation that has to be prohibited by the school. then that accommodation shouldn't burden survivors if possible. So like moving a perpetrator from a dorm room or from a class is preferable to moving a survivor from that situation. Because again, it's all about making sure that the survivor has equal access to education and that's not inhibited by what happened. Then that policies and procedures should also be easily written so that people can understand what is available on campus and that should be disseminated to students so that's available. So as a result of us connecting and talking about these laws and how our schools were violating them, we started to realize some really disturbing patterns. So some of the things that I mentioned, for instance, refusing to sanction assailants when they assault people who are unconscious or asleep or otherwise incapacitated, or allowing students who are found responsible to transfer from school to school without the school that's accepting them having any idea that the reason why they left was because of sexual assault. Failing to communicate during the investigation is another huge thing. That was something that I experienced at Cal, where I emailed them multiple times and they just wouldn't respond to me. That's something we see probably, that's probably the most common thing that we see from schools. Inconsistencies as well between schools' policies and practices. So like sometimes a school will say that they prohibit retaliation, but then when somebody brings forward a complaint, then they're, you know, not actually enforcing that. So holding schools accountable to not acting this way has been very important for us. And then as I mentioned, not putting the burden on the survivor for moving accommodations is very important as well. And we often didn't see that that was happening. Something that's unique to schools too is that students are often there for just a couple of years, and so schools can benefit from dragging out cases as long as possible so that either the survivor or the perpetrator graduates, which is again part of what happened in my case where they dragged it out until he could graduate a semester early without missing any classes for his major. Then survivors being unable to appeal cases even when there's bias or there's an error. And one of the most common things as well, just regardless of whether the school has a good process for adjudicating these cases, is that the materials that are handed out to students about preventing these kinds of incidents often talk about what the survivor should have done to prevent what happens, to have prevented what happened to them, as opposed to saying to people on campus, don't rape, don't sexually assault people, ask for consent. This is an example for how you should ask for consent. That's often not what we see when schools are educating students about campus safety. We often see things like, well, make sure that you're walking with a friend, or you know, don't go out too late, or make sure that you're always watching your drink. Like these can be things that are subconsciously sending the message to people who are reading these messages that, okay, if I didn't do these things, then somehow I'm to blame for what happened. So we really stress that we should not be solely educating women and girls about how to prevent ourselves from getting subjected from being subjected to these things, but rather that we should be telling men and people in general not to act this way. So in terms of, again, how we got to the point where we're talking about this issue, and I want to bring us back to thinking about where are we now and where are we going, especially with the new administration, I want folks to think about how a lot of this started in 2011 but has really taken on a new life of its own because of students and student activism. And so being cognizant of the fact that we're all here today because students spoke out and students had the took the initiative to hold their schools accountable, and therefore that should encourage you to realize that your voice also matters and that it is possible to make a difference in these really, really big picture ways. So the Department of Education published this letter, and students started using the letter to file complaints. And then really, in California, this amazing thing happened in 2014 where they decided in the state legislature to introduce a bill called Yes Means Yes, which I mentioned before. And that really took on a whole life of its own as well as other states around the country started to introduce similar legislation. And so now we're really looking towards, okay, what is the next thing that we can do in California? Because when California does something, then the rest of the country often follows. And so if there is something that you feel like is missing in your school, or that your school is not handling sexual harassment well, or students are being bullied on the basis of gender and nobody's taking it seriously, then I encourage you to pay close attention to what I'm about to tell you about organizing. But first, Mythbusters. So a lot of what we're doing is not just about changing policy, it's about changing the culture, right? So there are a lot of myths that exist around sexual assault and sexual violence that basically color our issue or how we see this issue. And so some of the things to definitely consider in terms of how they make you think about the issue of sexual assault and sexual harassment are the following myths. So first, that false accusations are common. So in fact, the rate of false accusations is the same as that of any other crime, which is between 2 and 8%. But people often say, well, I don't know, maybe she's making it up or that kind of thing. Then that sexual violence is only perpetrated by strangers, so like the person who jumps out of the bushes at you, when in reality, in between 80 and 90% of cases, it's somebody who you know. Then that revealing clothing or alcohol or previous hookups make the victim to blame. So again, saying that it's important that we educate people not to rape and not to commit sexual assault, as opposed to saying don't wear this or don't act a certain way. Then that nice guys or nice people don't commit rape. So unfortunately, you have these cases that are often from partners or from family members or from friends. So people who you think that you can trust can behave in these ways. And so unfortunately, it's not as if it fits a particular mold of what a perpetrator looks like. Then that men can't be sexually assaulted is another very pervasive myth. So 1 in 6 boys will be sexually assaulted before age 18. So this is not an issue that solely affects women. This is an issue that affects people of all genders. And there's also this myth, as Annie mentioned this morning as well, that sexual violence only affects straight white girls. So people who look like Annie and I are often overrepresented in the media conversation about sexual violence. And the only reason why people have listened to me is because I am a straight white girl who went to an elite university, and I come from an upper middle class background. If I had gone to a community college, you know, it's much less likely that people would be listening to what I'm saying right now. So just remember that as well, that privilege affects whose voices are heard, and that it's important to amplify the voices of those who are often not in the room. So that being said, women of color are disproportionately affected by sexual violence. So this is for cis women of color. The rates against Native women are particularly high, but they're higher for almost all demographics of women of color, higher than those of white women. So remembering that as well is very important, especially because there can be different ways that law enforcement or schools would interact with communities of color that white folks don't often consider. Then that the rates of sexual violence against folks from LGBTQ communities, so trans folks, are especially likely to be targeted for sexual assault both during school and over the course of their lifetime. So nearly half of people who identify as trans over their lifetime or LGBT experience sexual violence. And so these rates are incredibly high, and obviously those voices are often not represented both in the campus context and in the conversation about sexual violence in general. So that being said, all of this being said, I want you to think about how in your everyday lives you can make a difference. And First, I want to encourage everybody to think about how important it is to believe survivors and to make sure that as a friend or as a family member that you're supporting people if they disclose to you. And I'll tell you later about specific things to say in those situations. But this is a quote from a study which was talking about institutional betrayal. So the idea that our friends or our family or institutions can betray us when we need them most. So we as individuals have enormous power when it comes to just affecting one person's response and one person's feeling of being supported. And so if somebody discloses to us that they've experienced sexual assault, if someone discloses to us that they've experienced sexual assault, we want to make sure that we're supporting them in whatever way they need. If you go to a university and they fail to take action, then people often experience higher rates of PTSD, anxiety, and depression. And the same thing happens if you tell your friends and they don't believe you either. And that has real consequences as well in terms of whether you feel safe going to report the case or going to talk to a counselor as well. So high numbers of people on campus don't report because they didn't get that support from people that they were talking to, and if they told anyone at all. So now I'm going to get into some of the specific ways that you can advocate in your communities. So first, I want to say that this work is really hard. A lot of us, especially over the past couple of months, have been feeling that, you know, it can be too much at some points, and I want to really validate that. And, you know, this is something that is a marathon. It's not a sprint. You know, it's something that really does take you feeling like you are in a position to be able to help other people and not feeling like you're unable to do that. So I know that for me, it's often difficult to take a step back, but I try to as much as I can. I took a vacation out of the country for the first time in like 4 years, 2 weeks ago. So I encourage people to take care of themselves first and foremost. So in the legislature, this is the main thing that I would really stress to folks, although there are a couple of different things. We are going to have some sign-up sheets going around that are basically, we're going to have some, over the next year or so, some legislative bills that are going to be coming forward in the California state legislature for basically codifying some of the things that we've fought for really hard on the federal level. And so we want y'all to be involved in that as well. So if there are people in this room who could see themselves going to a legislative hearing or going to a press conference and talking about why they believe that this is important to have safety in school, then we encourage you to fill out the sign-up form, which I think is going around. Chardonnay, do you know where the sign-up sheet is? Okay, yeah, so the sign-up sheet will be going around. There are definitely legislators that we've worked with in the past who are interested in doing further activism this coming year. So we encourage folks to be involved in that way. Then also, you can be involved in your communities as well. So these are photos from high school. Almost all of them are photos from high schools. So the first one on the left is a school in Massachusetts where they did a walkout to protest how teachers were not responding adequately to sexual harassment and sexual assault complaints. So one of the quotes says that my boyfriend pressures me into having sex and does not understand no means no. That's one of the posters that's up there for folks over here. And there are other signs that people were holding about similar things, like things that they're called in the hallway, like whore or bitch or slut, things that you're experiencing on a regular basis in school. And so the students organized a walkout, and that ended up being covered in the Boston Globe. And now they're considering potentially filing a Title IX complaint against that school as well. Then there were also folks in Berkeley, at the Berkeley High School, who created a group called Berkeley Stop Harassing. So they created their own student group, And they also did a walkout and a petition drive as well for responding more adequately to these cases. So they ended up going to the Berkeley United School District board and gave public comment as well. So I encourage you to think about ways that you can have your voice heard in your community, and you know, where are people going to be making these kinds of decisions, and how can you influence them? So that could be, you know, organizing a petition drive or organizing a walkout, but also could be a teach-in as well. So we at NRAPE on campus do like Skype-in Q&As or Skype-in workshops. And so we are more than happy to host any of those for folks in this room who are interested in that as well. And also consent workshops are something that we can connect you to as well. So like I ran a student organization when I was on campus, and we did a consent workshop in the beginning of the semester. So that set the tone for what kind of behavior we expected in our group. So in the media, there are also really important things that you can do. So we created a hashtag campaign pretty recently called Dear Betsy, where we had folks explain to Betsy DeVos, Trump's education secretary nominee, why Title IX is important. So you had folks who were survivors, but also people who were allies saying, I believe that everybody has the right to be safe in school, and this is why you should protect and enforce Title IX. So everybody, regardless of whether or not you identify as a survivor, has a role to play in this movement. You can also write letters to your student newspaper or local paper as well, and reach out to local journalists if you're having an event that you would like covered. For more specific policy and more specific like sample letters and ways that you can organize on your campus, I encourage you to check out this campus organizing toolkit from our partner organization, Know Your Nine. You can go to bit.ly/organizeix, which has, as I said, these sample letters for op-eds and student government resolutions, so like our Bill of No Confidence at Berkeley, and also how to plan a campaign in further detail and how to work with the media. So I encourage folks to check that out. It's really, really amazing, and also explains a lot of the things that I've said in greater detail and gives you sample policy and ways that you can achieve that. I'm also more than happy to send this to anybody who would like to get a copy over email, but it is available online. Everyone good? Okay, cool. And then just in general, the importance of asking hard questions. So it can be difficult to feel like administrators will respond to you, but I encourage folks who are going to visit schools this coming year, so if you're going to tour college campuses or have been doing so already, to ask questions at the touring sessions and also to ask questions of other students who are there. So for instance, is your school committed to addressing the issue of sexual violence on campus? Is there a campus climate survey that exists? Is the school committed to helping marginalized students as well? So are there counselors in the counseling center who specialize in helping folks who identify as LGBTQ, for instance? Making sure that the policies are effective, but also that they're accessible for students. So do students even know that Title IX exists? This is a very basic question. You could ask this not just in college, but also at your high schools as well. Does your district have a Title IX coordinator, as is required under federal law? Those are things that you could ask at your school board meeting. Are there training programs that students are going through that they feel like are actually helpful to them? So a lot of the time people say, oh yeah, this university has this online program and it's great. It's like, okay, yeah, you can just like click through that. It's not necessarily going to actually change the way that people behave in their everyday lives. So really thinking about not just are they checking the boxes, but are they being effective in the measures that they're taking? Then also whether survivors are being supported academically and whether people know where to go just in general. Are these resources widely known on campus, or is it more like, oh, you have to look really hard on Google to find where you should go? And most importantly, do students feel safe coming forward, or do students feel like if they go to that institution that they're not going to be helped? So I mentioned earlier that supporting survivors is something that everyone can do, that is important for everybody to know how to do, especially because there are so many of us who are affected by this problem. So first I want to say, I know that statistically there are survivors in the room. And so I want to say from me and from Iraq that I believe you, I support you, and you're not alone. And that's exactly what you should also say to somebody else who has experienced this. Because sexual violence is about taking away power from someone else. And so you want to make sure that the person who's gone through this feels like they're empowered to do what's best for them and that they feel like they're being heard. So for instance, if someone discloses to me that they've experienced a sexual assault, then I will say those three things, but also give them the option to go to counseling and that I'll come with them, or that if they want me to look up local resources, that I'll happily do that. But to not force anything on them or not make them feel like, I don't want to make them feel as though they have to do anything. Again, this is about making sure that people feel like they have the agency to move forward in whichever way is best for them, to report or not to report, to seek counseling or not to seek counseling. All of these different things should be the survivor's decision. And to really validate how they're feeling and to not try and label it for them either. So sometimes people will say, yeah, it doesn't make sense. I don't know why I didn't fight back, but saying that's okay. That is a normal response. People respond to sexual violence by freezing. Like, it makes sense that that would happen. So, and you don't have to, I recommend that you don't label it as sexual violence as well. Don't call it something that the person who's affected hasn't called it yet. So if there's nothing else that you take from this today, this is the most important thing. So in terms of our overarching goals on campuses nationwide, we're really working to change the culture, but also we want to really ensure that schools themselves are changing and responding to the survivors who have spoken out over the years and have really worked very hard to hold our schools accountable. So some of the things that we've advocated for is the comprehensive education that's actually going to change the way that people act in their lives. Educating people about how you can ask for consent, how you can intervene in the situation. Then also making sure that survivors have adequate support on campus. So like, if you ask the university, do you have a counselor in the counseling center who had specialized with working with sexual assault survivors, and they say no, that would be a potential thing that you could advocate for on your campus. Having prompt, equitable adjudication processes. So one of the things that we've advocated for are campus climate surveys that actually are surveys of how students feel about the atmosphere on campus and the environment on campus. So do students feel safe coming forward? What proportion of students are experiencing sexual assault or sexual harassment? And when they came forward, if they came forward, how did they feel? And if they didn't come forward, how come? So those surveys are things that are really important for showing activists and also showing schools which ways they can improve. And that goes along with transparency and accountability. We want to make sure that schools are being held accountable, but that if they are doing things well, that they're also being rewarded for that. And having appropriate sanctions is one of those things. So my experience of, you know, being sexually assaulted and then having this person put on disciplinary probation and now he wants to go into politics and, you know, all of that, that should never happen. That is unacceptable. I'm a tireless advocate because I believe that what happened to me was wrong, and I don't want anybody else to go through a similar thing. So part of why I'm here today is because I feel so strongly about this, but also because I've seen how survivors like me and allies can really change the dialogue on a huge level, nationally and internationally, and I believe that you can as well. So that being said, I want to leave some time for questions, and I want to bring up Chardonnay Madkins, who is our project manager, and she's running this amazing program called Centering the Margins, which will be launching in the next couple months, which she can also tell you more about. So thank you. Questions? Cool. So we're going to be taking questions now. So if people wanted to line up behind the microphone. Yeah. There are two microphones. If people have questions and they want to line up, that would be great. And then Chardonnay.
Raise your hand if you can't physically.
And raise your hand if you can't physically get to the microphone, and we will call on you as well. So Chardonnay, if you wanted to introduce yourself. And then we'll start taking questions.
Okay. Hello, everyone. My name is Chardonnay Matkins. I'm the project manager at InterRape on Campus. And right now, I am working on Centering the Margins, which is an initiative aimed at centering marginalized communities in survivors' stories and uplifting their voices and those narratives since they are underrepresented in the national conversation. So we're going to be doing that through having culturally competent resources, because that is very, very rare. And then also a featured college tour and a blog and podcast series that will have different guest speakers from different marginalized groups to come on and speak about sexual violence in the intersection of gender expression, gender, race, sexuality, et cetera, in relation to sexual violence on campus.
Yeah. So if anybody is interested in participating in that program, we encourage you again to sign up on our email list and be involved that way. Cool. So now we'll start taking questions. Yes.
Hi, my name is Jordan. The reason I'm here is I have a 15-year-old sister who 2 weeks ago told me that she is being harassed by a kid in her class, and the teacher's response was to move her, which I could have flown back to Illinois. I was so pissed.
Yeah.
So my question with that is, obviously, I feel like even with all the things going on with the political world, I'm more aware of things that happened to me, and I'm like, oh, I didn't think that was a big deal in high school. And now I realize that's not okay.
Yeah.
So with Title IX, is there training with is that a part of the legislature that we have to get teachers to know, like, that's not the appropriate response, or is that where we're going, or is that a requirement at this time so I can go and drop the book on them when I go home tomorrow?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you're talking about Illinois specifically?
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Or just even, I guess it's countrywide. I mean, probably everybody's dealing with it, but I don't know if there's a blanket.
Yeah, so unfortunately there is no requirement for teacher training for consent and healthy relationships education, which is really frustrating. However, in California specifically, there is healthy relationship education that is required in high schools. So that is something that schools are supposed to have on the high school level, although whether teachers are being adequately trained for that is another issue entirely. So that's certainly one of the things that we have advocated for in California and Virginia and New York, but is not at this time a national thing. But that being said, that's again one of the ways that we would encourage people to get involved, is if you see something that you wish existed, if you wish that there was healthy relationship education in Illinois, that's something that you can contact the legislator who represents your district and say, look, this is something that has been a problem not just for me and my family, but for other people as well. I saw it when I was a student, and this is unacceptable and has to change. Let's follow what has been happening on other campuses across the country and create a healthy relationships curriculum.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. My name is Tim. Sophie and Chardonnay, thank you so much for being here today. I really wish there were more men in the room, and I think this is a conversation that, as you mentioned, is very important for men like myself to have amongst each other, because at the end of the day, that is where that conversation needs to be and is most impactful. I wanted to ask both a question and make a comment. I think that tackling such a big issue, as I'm sure you face, it can get very overwhelming, given that you mentioned it's a marathon and it takes so much energy to fight. And I think that can be overwhelming and discouraging, in that we don't often talk about the victories and the success stories enough, share best practices, and see how we can learn from each other's movements around the country to be more effective and work in unity together. So I wanted to ask first if you could share your most memorable best practice or success story, and I would love to share one that I'm aware of myself as well.
Sure, yeah, I completely agree that it makes a lot of sense to not just talk about the things that we're fighting, but also the ways that we have been able to make a difference. And I think that personally for me, one moment that I realized that everything had really changed was when the Stanford Survivor's Letter went viral this past year, and people were outraged by what she had written, that what she wrote really disturbed people. And I was so shocked by that. It, like, what happened to her didn't shock me, but the fact that people were mad about it, that to me signaled a sea change that had been the result of years of advocates and survivors speaking out and showing how systemic of a problem this is. So that for me was really, really, really amazing. I don't know if you have a moment as well, Chardonnay, where you felt like that it was a success for you or felt empowering to you or was inspiring.
I would say that it was more so of a best practice that I would have to share. And that's really just having cultural competency when we're addressing sexual violence. And when we assume that a survivor is always going to be straight, white, cisgender woman, then we're basically... we're taking away a lot of resources for some of the marginalized survivors. So for example, I know the number one thing that people always talk about is, well, did you go to the police? And the police are harmful to marginalized communities in general, just not even tacking on sexual violence. So obviously, marginalized survivors such as queer survivors or survivors of color, their first step isn't going to the police. And so I think sharing more about best practices about cultural competency and really motivating people to realize that this is something that is very necessary if we're trying to end sexual violence, that this is something that needs to be the number one thing that every single organization is doing, is making sure that their resources and their help is culturally competent and it's not just featuring one type of survivor and one type of story. Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I think that's extremely important and absolutely necessary. The quick success story I wanted to share is I attended the University of Maryland, and shortly after I arrived there, I noticed there was a protest to end sexual assault on campus at the University of Maryland. And so I got involved with a student organization that we had there as well, and we used many of the tactics you spoke about today. For example, getting the local media involved. And because the university administration, this was a huge PR problem for them. They didn't want to talk about it. They just wanted to sweep it under the rug, let people graduate, and not do anything about it. But because we got the local media involved and the local government, the president of the university was forced on a quarterly basis to meet with victims of sexual assault, our student group, and publish a report quarterly to say what the university was doing to end sexual assault. People were fired that were perpetrators, and we really put them on blast. And I would just recommend to, if we can replicate the work that you're doing around the country, share best practices, connect with each other here today, I think we'll be much stronger and we'll be able to continue the fight even stronger. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Elise Savari from the Harker School. Our Femme Club is hosting a screening for The Hunting Ground in March, and we want to hold a follow-up discussion about the screening after. And I was wondering if you had any advice about what the most important points to include were, and like what activities can we organize to get like all students engaged, ensuring more, I guess, administration responsibility in college institutions.
Yes. Okay. So, great idea. Something that I definitely should have mentioned, and thank you for bringing it up, is that hosting a screening of The Hunting Ground at your school can be a great way to start a conversation if there isn't one already on your campus. So that's one thing. In terms of having a Q&A, we often do Skype Q&As, so that's one thing that you could consider. But also, in general, for getting turnout to be you know, getting people to come. We've really found that having both involvement from top down and bottom up has been best. So both having administrators saying, you know what, this is a priority. We are going to go. We're going to show up and want to encourage people to participate by, for instance, giving extra credit or requiring that students go as a part of classes is a way to get people to come. Or if it's in college, sometimes we'll have like fraternities and sororities get like community service hours for coming to Q&As of the hunting ground and that kind of thing. And in terms of organizing from a student perspective, I would really encourage you to have folks who have seen the film and are motivated, like right after they've seen it, to be like, okay, now let's get other people to come and to do the work as well of like distributing flyers and sharing the word on social media and that kind of thing as well. But again, we're more than happy to help with being part of that program if that's something that you're interested in.
Oh,
as well.
Yeah, that would be totally awesome. If you all
cool. Great.
Today. I had a question at the at the national level. Going after criminal justice is notoriously unfriendly to survivors, and I was wondering how that compares to the university unfriendliness that you're talking about now, and how do you think about those two choices at the national level?
So Title IX ensures that all students are given equal access to education. And so a criminal justice system is just punitive and punishment, right? And so on a college campus, even if a perpetrator is not found responsible, the school is still obligated to make sure that the survivor can still have access to education. So that is either changing their housing so they don't have to live with their perpetrator or live in the same dorm room, like banning their perpetrator from being in these certain areas at certain times when the survivor is going to be there, making academic adjustments. So for example, a lot of survivors' GPAs like plummet when after an assault, which is reasonable. And so basically the administration is supposed to give different accommodations, such as taking an incomplete or giving students longer deadlines so they could still stay in class and they don't have to basically jeopardize their education over what something happened to them. And the criminal justice system is really about conviction. And how the criminal justice system treats rape is about, they make it a he said, she said story. So there's a rape kits are notoriously backlogged in a lot of states and a lot of counties. So that takes away the evidence. And so that also creates like this whole narrative of, well, he's saying this and she said this. Because another thing is that in a lot of states, they don't see queer or same-sex sexual violence as being something to, that's not like part of the law. So penetration of specific body parts might not necessarily be covered within the rape laws. So some queer survivors can't even report their rapes. And then another thing is that there's a 3% national conviction rate of sexual violence. And so that's literally 3 out of every 100 rapes that where someone might be convicted. And then of course, when we think about conviction, in Stanford, like the case in Stanford, conviction was 3 months of county jail. And so obviously these aren't appropriate sanctions. And for someone who is a perpetrator of sexual violence. And so really about the difference is really one, support the institution is supposed to support the survivor. And then the other one is just criminal is supposed to punish these people, and it's also based off of a high, very high legal standard beyond reasonable doubt compared to preponderance of evidence, which is 51% that this most likely happened. And it's about whether the DA decides if they're going to even bring charges or not, if they find if there's enough evidence or if this person is credible. And like we know, police and the criminal justice system is not immune to certain systems that are in place, like racism, sexism, ableism, etc. So if we have someone who is hard of hearing or is deaf, who is assaulted, then their perpetrator gets to basically set that narrative on the police side, because they could hear and they could effectively communicate compared to the survivor. And so the criminal justice system just doesn't really balance out getting survivors the support that they need, and it doesn't also balance out survivors' stories and their narratives compared to a perpetrator, because perpetrators, since for the Fifth Amendment, they could basically not say anything, and you know, and the survivor is the one who has to be put on the stand and is treated as a witness for the crime that happens. And of course, we know with something as traumatizing as rape, your memory kind of changes, or you kind of foggy memories, or like, I know that this happened specifically, but I can't remember everything in chronological order. So that really just, it's a system that really sets it up so survivors can't effectively tell their stories, and it doesn't effectively convict the people that they're supposed to be convicting. So that's why we always say that Title IX really gives survivors more agency and autonomy over what's going on. And it's really about them just getting an education, because if students weren't, or if students are on campus, then basically they're supposed to, they're just really trying not to drop out of school. That's like the ultimate, I think, goal, and to graduate. And I don't think that anybody's education should be taken away because of something that's happened to them. And that's what Title IX is supposed to do, is to protect those people. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Ivani. Thank you so much for the talk today. I have a question regarding the current political atmosphere.
Can you speak a little?
Oh, yeah, sure. I have a question regarding the current political atmosphere with the Trump administration. What is your perspective on the hurdles that we're going to be facing, and how can we overcome them?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that we have a lot of concerns, particularly with how Title IX is going to be enforced, and also whether students who identify as LGBTQ are going to continue to have their rights respected as well. So some of the things that we're concerned about with regards to Betsy DeVos being the next education secretary is whether she will continue to prioritize the rights of survivors. So for instance, my complaint against UC Berkeley was filed in February 2014, and that is still being investigated. So we want to make sure that they are continuing to devote resources to investigating these kinds of complaints. There are nearly 300 of them nationwide, and there are students who are relying on those complaints to get some sort of justice after having been wronged by their institutions. So we're really going to be working to put a lot of pressure on people who are going to be at the Department of Education, like Betsy DeVos, if she's confirmed, or the other Secretary of Education, whoever that is. They are going to be responsible for making sure that students are still having their rights enforced. So that was part of why we did the hashtag Dear Betsy campaign, is because we wanted her to commit during her hearing to protecting the Dear Colleague letter stuff that I mentioned. And she didn't do that in the hearing. She said it would be premature to commit to that. She also said she thought that disability laws should be state by state as opposed to federal. So these are some concerns that we have going forward. And so we'll be continuing to put pressure through social media and other forms of media. And so again, anybody who wants to be involved in these kinds of campaigns, please sign up for our email list and come and talk to me afterwards if you want to. So,
okay.
Just our last
question. Karen, I'm on the board of Watermark, and I just want to say
We are so happy to have you here. Your organization is amazing, and we deal in the business world, and what you folks have done is taken an incredibly complex problem and broken it down into all sorts of component parts and then put in something actionable and caring and loving in every one of those areas. And what are you, there's like eight of you or something?
Five.
Okay. So we're blown away, and thank you so very much. Quality, loving, beautiful work.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Well, thank you so much for being here today. If you would like to contact Chardonnay or myself, you can reach us on Twitter or our website, nrapeoncampus.org. We would love to be connected with you in the future. So please contact us if you have any questions or would like to be involved. Thank you so much.